Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. Just as butterflies flapping their wings in Asia can cause storms to appear on the other side of the world, your time spent in mentioning the podcast to your friends, neighbors, colleagues, and other people can make a real difference in increasing our listenership. Thanks for taking the time to mention the podcast. In this podcast, Rabbi Schweiger discusses Parshat Pinchas. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as a Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
This week's Parsha is Parshat Pinchas. I would like to examine the personality of Pinchas and touch on the issue of zealotry. Let us begin by looking at the last verses in Parshat Balak, chapter 25, verse 1, the verses which set the stage for this act of zealotry. And Israel settled in the area of Shittim, and the people began to prostitute with the daughters of Moab, and the women call out to the people to partake of the sacrifices to their God. And the people eat, and they bow down to their gods. And then they worship the idol of Peor. And God's anger rages against the Jewish people. And in verse 4, and God says to Moshe, take the heads of the people. Hang those sinners against God, opposite the sun, so that the anger of God against Israel will be assuaged. And in verse 5, and Moshe says to the judges of Israel, kill each man among you, his people, those who have worshipped the idol of Peor. Without going into the details of what exactly happened here, but somehow it seems that the daughters of Moab, and according to the rabbinic tradition, the daughters of Midian, a collaboration between Moab and Midian, seduce the Jewish people, but not only to engage in prostitution, sexual immorality, but sexual immorality which turns into an orgy of idolatry. This incident raises the anger of God, and God tells Moshe to step in, act, exact punishment from the perpetrators, before that anger of God will destroy the Jewish people. There are all kinds of echoes in this story to the golden calf. We know that God was prepared to destroy the Jewish people. It is only when Moses does an act of zealotry that this is prevented. In this situation, Moses is told by God what needs to be done. Moses tells the judges, everything is poised for action. And before there is an opportunity to execute the punishment, we are told in verse 6, and behold, there is a man from among the people of Israel who came, who brings near to his brothers the Midianite woman, before the eyes of Moshe, before the eyes of the congregation of Israel. And the people are crying at the tent of meeting. This is a very enigmatic verse. Who is this man? Who is the woman? What is going on? Why is everyone crying? We learn later on that the man, and this is the beginning of our parsha, in verse 14, chapter 25, verse 14, the name of that man is Zimri ben Salu, the prince of the tribe of Shimon. The name of that woman is Cosbi, the daughter of Tsur. Tsur, who is a head, a leader of the Midianites. So that we're not just talking about any man and any woman. And in fact, in the Talmud, in the tractate Sanhedrin, 82a, the story is fleshed out. In the words of the Talmud, After the verdict has been decreed by God and Moshe passes it on to the judges, the tribe of Shimon come to their prince, Zimri, and they say to him, the judges are now engaged in an act of capital punishment. They're about to kill those people who have been engaged in the orgy of sexual immorality, idolatry, and you just sit and are silent? And Zimri's response is to gather 24,000 men from among the Jewish people. He goes to Cozbi. He propositions her to have sexual relations with him. And she responds in a defiant way, my father told me to only agree to have relations with the chief among you. And he says, yes, I am a prince. I am an even greater figure than Moses. And in the language of the Talmud, he pulls her by her hair. He brings her before Moshe. The imagery of her being this object that he is now using in order to make a point. And then he presents a question statement to Moshe. And again, in the language of the Talmud, you son of Amram, a language that despises Moshe, that ridicules Moshe, belittles him. Is this woman permitted to me, or is she forbidden? And if you say she's forbidden, who allowed you to marry a Midianite woman? Zimri is now creating a test case. As people would say, he puts Moshe behind the eight ball. He puts him in a very untenable position. Not only is he trying to deflect the capital punishment which is about to be executed, he's going one step further. He is trying to legitimate what has just happened, to institutionalize what happened, to in effect point the finger at Moshe and say, who are you? How can you possibly condemn what we are doing? You did the same thing. Moshe is neutralized, incapacitated. In the language of the Talmud, he forgot the halakha. But perhaps it's not so much he forgot the halakha as he's not in a position to rule here. And when that happens, the people surrounding him burst out crying. No one knows what to do. This is the background for what then happens in verse 7. And Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen, sees. He gets up from among the congregation and he takes a spear. And in verse 8, he goes after that Israelite man into the tent. He spears the two of them, the Israelite man and the woman, in her stomach. And the plague stops from the Jewish people. What did Pinchas see? In the language of the Talmud, Pinchas sees what is going on and remembers the halakha. And the Talmud said, Pinchas immediately comes before Moshe. He becomes Moshe's mouthpiece and says, did you not teach us that one who cohabits with an Aramean woman should be put to death by zealots? And Moshe, rather than acknowledging and instructing him, yes, Moshe says, in the graphic language of the Talmud, let the reader of the letter be the one to deliver it. And the Talmud goes on to say, the acts of a zealot are incorporated in the law, but we do not instruct them to do so. Moreover, Pinchas killed Zimri and Cozbi in the act. According to the Talmud, had Zimri consummated the sexual act, separated from Cozbi, Pinchas would not have the right to kill him. And were he to do so, he would be considered a murderer. Even when Zimri is in the act, if Zimri were to then defend himself and kill Pinchas, he would be acquitted, because this would be seen as an act of self-defense. What do we see from these laws of the Talmud? Acting as a zealot is not something which is mandated by the law. It is an extra legal measure which is acknowledged by the law, which is validated. But it is an extra legal measure which a zealot needs to assume. It is his choice to take on the role of being a zealot. And when that person takes on that role, he is running a risk. The risk that if he doesn't do it within the correct parameters, he could be called a murderer, put on trial for having committed an act of murder. Moreover, he risks his life. If the violator were to kill him, that is seen as an act of defense. Zealotry is not carte blanche. According to the Talmud, there are very clear guidelines. Even more so, the zealot runs the risk. There is a very fine line between what is considered to be a praiseworthy act of zealotry and a condemnable act of murder. Let me add another point. I mentioned earlier, verse 7, where it says, Pinchas saw. Perhaps we can connect this verse with another verse, which appears in the book of Exodus, in chapter 2, verse 12. Moses, who was grown up in the court of Pharaoh, one day leaves the palace and sees an Egyptian who is beating, perhaps I will add, mercilessly beating, his brother, Moshe's brother, a fellow Hebrew. And Moshe turns here and there, and he sees there is no man. And he strikes the Egyptian, and he buries/hides him in the sand. An Egyptian is beating a Jew. He is committing a crime. No one is doing anything about it. And Moshe then steps in and performs an act of zealotry. When he looks here and there, he weighs the situation. By analogy, I would like to say, when Pinchas is looking, he is also weighing the situation. There is a verse in Tehillim which says, Vayamod Pinchas Vayafalel, on 82b in the Talmud. They quote this verse. This is a verse from Psalms 106:30. And they say, what does Vayafalel mean? We could associate it with prayer, but they say that Pinchas is actually making a judgment or bringing God to judgment. I would like to do a slight variation and say that Pinchas is judging the situation, evaluating it. And if I go back to what we mentioned earlier, when Pinchas sees that there's been a total breakdown in the camp, that no one is acting, that Moshe has been neutralized, there is the need to have someone act in order to stem the tide. In the same way that Moshe acts in the case of the Egyptian beating the Jew, in the same way that Moshe acts when he comes down the mountain, when the Jews are worshiping the golden calf, smashes the tablets, breaks the calf, burns it, ultimately rallies the tribe of Levi and kills all those who've been involved in the worship of the calf, Pinchas is now replacing Moshe. He has become the zealot who will now come into the breach, sanctify God's name. And as I mentioned, Pinchas runs a tremendous risk. And in fact, in the language of the Talmud, the day after, the people come and say, "Who are you to have done such a thing? You whose grandfather fattened calves to idols," which is seen as being an allusion to Yitro, that we're told that Pinchas married, Pinchas' father, Elazar, married the daughters of Putiel. And the rabbis say Putiel is Yitro. Putiel, related to the word lifatem, to fatten, who fatten calves for the purpose of idolatry. Who are you? The one who embraced that family of idolaters to now pass judgment on us, condemn us as being idolaters, licentious. You who also embraced Midianites, who are you to now condemn us for clinging to Midianites? Note that in our parsha, the parsha begins in chapter 25, verse 10. And God said to Moshe, saying, "Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has assuaged my anger from the Jewish people in performing an act of zealotry in their midst. And I did not destroy the Jewish people in my jealousy. Therefore say, behold, I am establishing to him a covenant of peace. And there will be to him and his children after him a covenant of everlasting priesthood. In return for the fact that he was zealous to his God and atoned for the Jewish people." This is a fascinating statement. First of all, God is validating the act of Pinchas. Rather than seeing Pinchas' action as being that of a hothead, that of an extremist, that of a murderer, God says his zealotry, his kin'ah, has deflected my kin'ah, my jealousy. My jealousy of what the Jewish people were doing that would have led to their destruction. But more so, I will establish a covenant of peace with him. God is now conferring to Pinchas the status of priest and giving to his children forever that status. According to the rabbinic understanding, Aaron and his children were chosen to be priests. Pinchas was not around at that time. Pinchas is now meriting the priesthood in his own right. And as we have described in this verse, it is very appropriate that he should be the priest. The role of the priest is to bring atonement upon the Jewish people. That is exactly what Pinchas accomplished by his act of zealotry, to cause the plague to stop, to somehow bring about a reconciliation between God and his people. What is this covenant of peace which God is establishing with Pinchas? On the one hand, one could say that God will perhaps deflect from Pinchas whatever criticism may exist in the aftermath of his action. In light of what I mentioned earlier in the Talmud, when people begin criticizing Pinchas, perhaps accusing him, rallying against him, God is saying, that will all stop. I will bring about the recognition, the acceptability of what Pinchas did in the eyes of the Jewish people. But I would like to suggest another explanation, and that is committing an act of zealotry in the manner of Pinchas, which meant killing someone, is diametrically opposed to the role of a priest. A priest is supposed to be the one who prolongs life, not curtails life. Golda Meir once said, her gripe against the Arab nation is not that they killed Jews, but that they made Jews into killers, Israelis into killers. This is the challenge of anyone who is involved in killing, which is for defensive purposes, for noble purposes. How are you able to come to terms with the act so that it has not transformed your psyche? How can you maintain your love of life, your value of human dignity, after you've taken someone's life? And here what God is saying is, I am establishing a covenant of peace. Despite what Pinchas did, he will be invested with peace. His persona will be a persona of peace. That is a special blessing of God. There is a fascinating story which appears later on in the book of Joshua. This is Joshua chapter 22. And I will try to just do this very, very briefly. In next week's Parshiot, we are told of the story of Gad and Reuven, who come to Moshe and request that they be given the lands on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Moshe agrees to their request on condition that these two tribes cross the Jordan, join the Jewish people in their battle to conquer the land of Israel. And only once the Jewish people have taken possession of their land will they be allowed to go back to the land on the eastern side of the Jordan. And in fact, we are told in the book of Joshua that the tribe of Gad and the tribe of Reuven did exactly as they had committed themselves to do. Joshua acknowledges that in the very beginning of chapter 22. He says, you have in effect observed everything which you committed yourselves to. And now, go to your land, the land that will become your possession. But just remember to observe the mitzvot and the Torah, to love God. And when the children of Gad and Reuven, the soldiers, go back before they cross the Jordan, as they're about to go to their homeland, they build an altar, a big altar. And when the Jewish people hear this, they all gather together. What is going on in this story? It seems to be that the Jewish people interpret the actions of the tribes of Gad and Reuven as being an action which is to set up an alternate altar, worship of God, to be an act of cessation, of secession. They are now seceding from the Jewish people. They perhaps have now formed a separate nation. And then a delegation is sent. One could say a fact-finding mission. And at the head of the delegation is Pinchas. And they come to them, and this is Joshua chapter 22, verse 16. They said, what are you doing? What is this act of sacrilege in building this altar? And then they say in 17, don't you remember what happened in the story of Peor, when there was this great plague which came forth before God? Do you want to rebel once again and bring about this plague? there is the feeling over here of how every Jew is responsible for the other, of how what one segment of the population does reflects on the rest of the population. The general Jewish population is not allowing them to now commit this breach and is saying to them, what you're doing is no different than what happened earlier. And then the tribe of Gad and Reuven go on to explain their actions and to say that, in fact, this altar is not meant to be a place of worship. It is meant to be a monument, a reminder to you that you should not forget, you the Jewish people, that we are also part of the Jewish people. Rather than building this altar as a way of dividing the Jewish people, this altar is being built as a way of reminding the Jewish people, even though we're on two sides of the Jordan, we are one people. And what matters to me is what it says in verse 30. Pinchas and the princes hear their words, and it is good in their eyes. And it emphasizes, and Pinchas says to them, today we know that you are in our midst, that you in fact have not betrayed God. And then they send them away in peace. This story is a very important complement to our story. It shows what a true zealot is. A zealot is not somebody who's looking for action. A zealot is not somebody who's a hothead, who just acts on knee-jerk responses. A zealot is someone, a true zealot, who sees the act of zealotry as being a last resort, who tries to explore every channel of negotiation, who, if there is a possibility of reaching an amicable solution, will go for that. And that is what we see in the story of Joshua, who negotiates before they take up the sword. But there may be some extreme situations where there is the need for immediate action, where there is no room for negotiation, and where if there is inaction, that can lead to chaos, pandemonium, to destruction. So that the zealot, rather than destroying, is really preserving, is saving. In our story, Pinchas runs the risk between desecrating God's name and sanctifying God's name. It is a very fine line. It says in our story, he arises from among the community, from the congregation. This is not something which he relishes, which he does easily. It takes a superhuman effort. But in the words of Hillel, where there is no man, you have to be the man. If not now, then when? There are certain moments when zealotry is absolutely critical. I just want to add one last thing. The Netziv, who I've mentioned on previous occasions, comments in a number of places that a zealot has to be somebody who is acting completely for the sake of heaven, who has absolutely no ulterior motive. If we think about it, that is a very heavy duty expectation. And that would mean that anyone would have to ask themselves a million times, what is motivating me? And if someone does not ask that question, it could very well be that they will be put on trial the next day for murder. Zealotry is not advocated. Zealotry is allowed. In some instances, it is critical in turning the tide. Pinchas is a model of a zealot. And let me conclude by saying, those zealots who truly are L'shem Shamayim, those who truly sanctify the name of God, those are the ones who in the end have a covenant of peace, who ultimately bring about peace. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always important to us. Please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.